You are listening to Studying Pixels, a bizarre yet bona fide podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan Heinrich Siemond. I'm a game studies scholar from Germany.
I'm Dan Hughes, a Japanese scholar from Texas.
And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. We're going to talk about The Quarry today, and we're going to try our very best to keep it spoiler-free. I think we can do that, can't we?
I think so, and I also think sometimes I'm on the fence about giving spoilers or not. This is a game where you should play it. It's worth going in not knowing what's going on.
The less you know, the better it is. And that's kind of the premise that we're going to apply for this review as well. We might draw from certain examples, but we phrase them in such a way that we don't give any crucial developments of the story away. Because yeah, it's really, it's a cinematic decision-based horror adventure developed by Supermassive Games. They had great success with Until Dawn in 2015. Until Dawn, I have such fond memories of that game.
I think genuinely one of my favorite horror games. Actually,
yeah,
I really love the story and the twists and turns that those characters take. And I can't remember another game where I've been genuinely and thoroughly surprised like Until Dawn.
I think it was probably the most apt adaptation of this very cinematic decision-based style into the horror genre. I mean, we've had such things like, of course, The Walking Dead, for example, and Life is Strange, Batman, all kinds of games that came out at the time that were like focused on like reducing the amount of just gameplay skill and really trying to challenge players to make decisions and to relate to the characters.
Mm.
And Until Dawn certainly was one of the most interesting ones, especially because I think at the time when Until Dawn came out, it felt to me like nobody, including Sony, really knew what they had at their hands.
Yeah.
At their fingertips. They developed this game and it was like people were getting excited about it. And Sony kept like really, you know, keeping it a little bit under the radar, you know?
Yeah. I remember at the time thinking that was strange because it was so well put together. And the motion capture and the cinematography, I mean, it was really like playing a film. And I think that it struck me as weird, and I think at the time I just chalked it up to the fact that it was horror, and that's kind of a niche genre anyway. But I agree with you, it did feel like they were kind of sweeping it under the rug, despite it being this incredible little experience that those in the know really remember fondly, like we do.
And ever since then, since this, I would say, surprise hit of Until Dawn, Supermassive Games, they really tried to kind of, well, up the ante, to exceed the expectations of their players, and they have consistently failed to do so. they did such things like spin-offs. You remember this? There was an Until Dawn, something of blood, where you're like in a VR roller coaster.
Yeah, yeah. I never played it because I don't know if this is maybe the curse of having a really good property right out the gate, is that you're always chasing the dragon with it a little bit. And I remember seeing that at the time and thinking, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I'll watch that on YouTube if I can, but I never did. So,
yeah. And it wouldn't be a good experience either, because it was Rush of Blood was its name. I just looked it up, and it was a VR game where you're sitting in a roller coaster and you're basically just shooting. You're shooting everything.
Yeah.
It's like a shooting gallery, and it's a fun game, but it draws from characters of Until Dawn and like the horror tropes that it evoked, but it doesn't really go anywhere with it. It's not a substantially narrative experience. It's more like an arcade shooting gallery.
Here's what I'll say. I think that, and we can go into this whether The Quarry succeeds in this or not, but I think that the real key to Until Dawn's success and why that VR game kind of fell by the wayside is because despite it being a horror property, it's a really compelling mystery story. And I think that might be the stumbling point for Supermassive after Until Dawn.
Yeah, exactly. Especially because they try to go further in that direction with their Dark Pictures anthology.
Yeah.
Where they started to then say, well, as many publishers do or many developers do, we've had a successful game. Why don't we ruin it all by putting a game out every single year? You know? Well, why don't we see how much quantity we can produce completely neglecting quality?
And now you have a particular history with those Dark Pictures games, which I bypassed, and I think I was going to check them out until I heard your opinion on them.
Yeah, it's not worth it. The thing is that they started out with Man of Medan in 2019, and that game actually looked quite promising. I remember I played it before it released at Gamescom, and it was pretty intriguing. It was pretty cool. It relied a bit on jump scares, just like all of these games do, but the atmosphere was nice. However, it turned out it felt pretty flat. Mm. It was a horror game where you have like a group of young adults exploring an old like ghost ship, like an industrial tanker. And it was just not an interesting setting because everything looked exactly identical wherever they were on the ship. And then they went ahead and they said, okay, why don't we do Little Hope next? That came out 1 year later. And that was like set in a small village, strongly inspired by Silent Hill. Mm. And while it did have some nice ideas, again, with, you know, like ghosts and all this kind of stuff, like it was tied to the witch hunts.
Oh, okay.
It's still, it always has like good ideas. There's always a seedling of an excellent idea there, but then it kind of loses itself in implementing all kinds of tropes and not being consistent enough, not drawing the consequences from their own game design, basically. And then the peak was, and that's a terrible peak in that sense, House of Ashes in 2021, where they said, why don't we make it more of a military setting, which is always a great idea for horror.
Yeah.
So why don't we put a couple of characters in the war in Iraq and have them basically plummet into a cave where they encounter some old like vampire creatures, and they have rifles and stuff. It's still a decision-based game and it's not in itself terrible, but it had some issues with, I tried to review it back then with a friend of mine, and the online connection would just not work. And we checked everything, and it's still for weeks on end, they couldn't get the servers running properly. The game itself was not really worth the struggle to try to get it to run, basically.
Well, that's a shame, because I do appreciate good horror narratives, which I feel we got a glimpse at the possible future, which is set in space, with horror games that are coming out after Summer Games Fest. But I really like when video games are set in a horror setting and they take a lot of chances. So I'm always willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And it always kind of bums me out, because I'm a huge horror fan, when things fall flat. Because as you said, there's nothing worse than a wasted idea. And when you see an idea that you think, oh, that's really good, I wish that they had done X, Y, and Z with it, it kind of leaves a sour taste in your mouth. So there's a little bit of that in The Quarry, but I don't know. I'm a little more on the side of maybe this is a return to form to Until Dawn, but we can get into that, see if where we end up.
I've been wondering about whether it is a return to form. Mm. It certainly is an attempt to do so, because this time around, they decided not to continue in the treads of the footsteps of the Dark Pictures anthology. Mm. They instead basically disconnected The Quarry from that anthology and made it very clear that this is basically a spiritual successor to Until Dawn. It's not directly tied to it, but it sails in the same wake.
Mm.
Or sails in its wake. The thing is, I was quite baffled when suddenly The Quarry came out, because House of Ashes, the game before that, it came out in, I think, in late 2021. So that would be October, I think, October 2021. And in June 2022, so less than a year, they put out The Quarry. And that's why I can only reason that, or speculate that, they have been working on The Quarry on the side all this time, to then see whether they are going to do anything with it, and found it sufficiently interesting to say, let's release that thing.
I think I agree with you. And it does have a certain level of polish to it, which makes me think that it's probably been in the works for a while. And it's not perfect visually, but it's a pretty impressive looking game. So it does give the impression that this was not just all right, this is this year's idea, like the Dark Pictures maybe were. It seemed more like maybe this has been in the works since after the success of Until Dawn.
Yeah, and it's closely tied to the tropes that we've seen in Until Dawn already. It returns to this idea of the teenage horror slasher, which is creepy to a certain degree, but never so creepy that you are like actually frightened. It's not The Grudge or something like that. It's not psychological in that way.
Yeah,
only very minimally so. It's mostly just like a almost like fun slasher thing. It's not comedy, but it has a lot of comedic elements.
Mm.
It is about a group of summer camp counselors that stay at Hackett's Quarry, and summer camp is basically coming to an end. All the kids have left and everyone's on the way out. So there's this dude, he's called Jacob. He's one of the main characters, and he wants to spend another night at camp because he hopes that then he can still have a chance with his crush, Emma. Mm. However, so he manipulates the car so they can't leave and they have to stay another night. But it turns out that things go sideways fairly quickly as the teenagers, as they are, do not follow the instructions of the camp supervisor, and instead they have a party and things go sideways fairly quickly. And in which way and how good the story actually is that unfolds, we'll tell you that in a second. But first, we have to briefly mention that if you like this show and want to make it happen, then you can support us by joining Studying Pixels Plus. There you will get all of our episodes entirely ad-free, a lovely sticker, and monthly plus episodes. Amazing! Wow. If you are as excited as I am, because I'm subscribed to Studying Pixels Plus, I'm always curious what we produce next.
Oh yes, same here. It's always a fun surprise.
It's always a fun surprise. You never know what will be on that plus feed. You can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And we are back talking about the quarry and about the beautiful nostalgia of the summer coming to an end. I think there's just something so appealing about the setup of summer camp is basically over. Everyone has to return to their normal lives and nobody really wants to. And so they just decide, you know, we're going to have one last big party, a campfire blowout, as they call it.
Yes, one last glorious night of summer. Especially the characters in this game are all, they're all going to college soon. And so this is kind of the last chapter of this part of their life.
It always feels so appealing to me. I think for some reason, the end of summer is one of the most appealing seasons to tell a story in.
Yes.
Because it's just things are coming to an end. There's a certain inevitability to the way that life progresses and moves on and changes people. And these people that we experience going through certain changes and hardships, they are all real stereotypes, proper stereotypes. Mm. We've got to know a lot of them in Until Dawn, but also in a lot of horror films. We've got like the typical jock. We've got the hot babe that is just like basically what she primarily is hot. We've got like the witty Asian lady, the recluse, the shy girl. They're all kind of there.
Yes, we've seen these characters before. And one of the things that I think Supermassive does well, at least in Until Dawn and this, I would argue, is they have a certain awareness of the tropes that they comment on without it being too much in your face and annoying. It's just sort of, okay, everybody kind of fits their role and they're aware of their role to a certain extent, but they're not calling out the narrative structure of what their roles mean all the time. That kind of meta-narrative kind of gets on my nerves a bit.
Yeah, you can also influence the way they play out their roles and the way they develop as characters a little bit. Usually you always have like at least two different options on how to progress and what to say. And that really shapes the extent to which that character fulfills the trope of whether you make the jock, for example, a proper douchebag or only an occasional douchebag who also has a soft spot.
I remember a character, and this is something that will probably come up multiple times because I think very fondly on Until Dawn. And what Until Dawn did was it would present you with these tropes, and then the jock would turn out to have a heart of gold. And so he would kind of be flipped on his head. Whereas in a normal horror movie, especially from the 80s, a jock is really just a character that's going to get slashed up at some point. But in Until Dawn, they say, no, well, think a little bit more. He's a fully fleshed out character. And so I went into this game with that expectation. And I think that it did a pretty good job of making them feel like fully realized people who were a little more than their tropes pretty early on.
Yeah, who are a little bit more than their tropes, definitely. But it never really goes out of its way, I found, to subvert the tropes or surprise you with like character developments. Because at least in the way that I played it, it mostly was like, yeah, the jock remained exactly that. And
he really did.
The hottie, she's kind of... She stays the hottie. She doesn't like come around all of a sudden. And of course she's like, of course she's got like emotions, and of course she's a fleshed out character, but it's not like it flips the script on these tropes. It rather presents them and puts them into challenging situations. And then it's up to you to decide to which degree you want to play out the stereotype.
I have a question for how you played this. Did you choose to, when you had, because this is a choice-based game. So did you make the choice based on what you assumed these characters would really do? Or did you make the choice thinking you were in their shoes? What would you do?
I mostly choose in accordance to the character, just because it's so many different characters. If it was just one person I would play, then I would infuse them with my own values. Mm. But since it's so many different characters, I think 9 in total, which is quite a lot for such a game, then I play out the characters a little bit. Though what I do is, and that's, I think, an important distinction, I don't necessarily play them in accordance to how they would work in a horror movie, but how I would expect them to act in real life, such as when you hear like a weird noise, then in case of doubt, you run and you're not like slowly investigating until it bites your head off.
Right, yes. I think I did the same thing. And I remember, I always know that I'm having a fun time with a game if I'm speaking out loud to the TV. And there were moments where, as you describe, a character would be given the option to either run or hide. And I would say, there's no way you're outrunning this thing. Hide. And that's what I think you would do.
Mm, that's exactly how it works. Should you climb up a tree or run? And I'm like thinking, I'm not going to climb up that.
I'm trapped.
Thing can climb up the tree easily. That'd be a terrible idea. In a horror film, you would maybe see that. And you would maybe think to yourself like, oh God. But here you have the option to influence the outcome.
That's the most fun about these games to me, is that when you're sitting in a cinema and you're watching a horror film and you're screaming at the screen, what are you doing? Don't go that way. You can actually make the character go a different way and say, this is the smart way to do it. And that's kind of going back to the trope idea. I appreciate that it didn't flip the script, because I feel like if it flipped the script, I would almost get annoyed, because it would feel like, well, I'm trying to play this role as this character who fits the jock stereotype, or fits the witty stereotype, right? And so if at a certain point that was completely turned on its head, I would almost feel betrayed for falling for a trope or something. And I'm glad that it didn't do that in this game.
It doesn't attempt to be Cabin in the Woods.
No.
It has a little bit of the tone, because it's often very tongue-in-cheek. And what I found very interesting is that even though there are like very existentially threatening situations, there's a high tension and a lot of danger that these characters face. But at the same time, they're always like weirdly witty, and they're like bickering amongst each other, teasing each other, making like silly word plays or jokes. So they always keep it light, but never to a degree that it would become absurd or that it would become just like comedic.
Yeah, when they need to be scared out of their wits, they are scared.
Yeah. It's so well conveyed, which is also probably due to the fact that the cast of the quarry is such a high quality.
Star-studded.
We've got like, yeah, absolutely. Bafflingly star-studded from all kinds of different horror series and horror franchises. We've got like actors from Scream, from Insidious, from Halloween, 13 Reasons Why. Oh my God, I could go on and on with this list. Aliens, The Terminator. Wow.
It's pretty great. And you know, it's fun too, because you see, sometimes that can be jarring when high profile actors show up in video games, because you feel like it's maybe stunt casting a little bit. Like I know it took me a while, for example, to warm up to the elusive man in Mass Effect, because he was played by Martin Sheen. So it's sort of like, okay, I recognize this is an old Hollywood guy. This is kind of strange. But seeing David Arquette as the head of the camp, you think, oh, good. All right. I know what I'm getting with this guy. It's David Arquette. He's a horror icon.
Yeah. He plays the cop in Scream, right?
Yeah. He's Sheriff Dewey in the Scream series. And he's he's got a certain, he's comfortable. See if this scans. Anytime he plays a character, he seems to be comfortable with how uncomfortable he is as an actor.
Yeah. Yeah, that is true. And he's very expressive. Mm. And the thing is that, talking about expressiveness, these actors and their performances, which are, I would say, very consistently good, are really brought to life by an impressive motion capture technology. It is really amazing. I was actually quite stunned. For example, there's a character called Caitlin. She's the witty agent that I referenced. Mm. She's played by Brenda Song. And her character model is so well made in the quarry that when I played it on like an OLED TV, and when she would sit by the campfire and the light would flicker a little bit on her face, she would be like half sitting in the shade. It would look so photorealistic that I would just take a screenshot of it and I would just be like, wow, this is a point where I would look at this and I would not be able to distinguish whether this is a video game, whether that's actually just a picture of someone.
Her more than most too, I think. That they may have put a little more effort into her model because I would say that she's the most consistent, and it is incredible whenever she's on screen, because it does look like you're watching just a film with Brenda Song in it. And that doesn't always carry over to the other characters all the time. But for the most part, it is, when you do feel like you're watching a film. It's pretty incredible how real it looks. And I would say that in any other type of game, that would almost take me out of it. It would make me feel like I'm playing a Sega CD full motion video game or something. But the fact that it's so well put together and it's made to be a cinematic experience with your kind of minimal input, I think makes it work in a really cool way.
Yeah, and I think that's really where Smartly draws its highlights on, because this game is really a game about faces and about facial expressions.
Yeah.
Like, the camera is almost always in a detailed or close-up shot at someone's face, and while people are talking, the environments are often like, yeah, okay, they're atmospheric, and sometimes there's a cool vista here and there, but often it's just like dark, bland woods, or even like a little bit like glitchy stuff going on, a little bit of like repetitive textures. It's clearly not been the priority to design like an interesting environment, or an especially high fidelity environment. But all the effort really went into bringing these characters to life. And I think that's the right decision to make, because really it's all about interacting with others, making decisions. And that's why it's probably the right choice to make.
I totally agree. And I think that I was always far more captivated with just thinking, wow, that's such a realistic expression. I remember there's a character, a kind of clairvoyant character, who's sort of the narrator or your guide throughout the interstitials in the chapters. And her motion capture was so captivating because of how she had like a lazy eye, and she had a very particular way of talking, and it grabbed your attention anytime she was speaking, to the point where I looked forward to those inner chapter moments because I wanted to see more of that actress.
You know, when the clairvoyant here, who basically, she plays the role of the narrator, you could say, whenever she was on screen, it was a little bit eerie for me because she looks very similar to my grandma.
Oh, no. Really?
including things like the lazy eye or the way her lips move in relation to her teeth. It's all so detailed that I almost felt like, grandma, is that you? Suddenly appears on screen. And she's really interesting. And I think she's one of the great new additions because in Until Dawn, there was the situation that these Supermassive Games titles, they always have a narrator. In Until Dawn, it was a psychiatrist. In the Dark Pictures anthology, they established this exceedingly pretentious librarian who, like, he would walk down the hallway and you would get this like cool intro where he's like to some like rock music. He's like walking down the thingy and he would be like, a narrator that is a little bit too cool for what he's supposed to do.
Yeah. So he was like a fun take on the horror movie host, that kind of character, like, oh, now in this tale, let me show you with my cool rock music.
Yes, it is like from the X Factor, you know?
Yeah. What a great start to your horror game.
And in The Quarry, they have this interesting clairvoyant who also has a little bit more of a tie to the actual setting and the actual story. And they also changed up the system in which you can take a glimpse into the future. As it is decision-based, you obviously want to get as much information as possible to make an informed decision. In previous games, that was the case by collecting totems that would show you the future or other kind of items. In this case, now it's all circled around tarot cards. Mm. You would collect these cards. They would, they're not laying in the environment as such, but they are always hidden in a certain camera angle. And when you walk down a path, then the camera would jump and you just have to press the X button to collect that card. It's fairly easy and straightforward, and it doesn't disrupt the flow, because in a cinematic game, you don't want to be someone who basically goes off the beaten path and constantly needs to explore and, you know, try to be completionistic. Instead, you just want to go with the flow of the story.
I think it was implemented a lot better than the totems in Until Dawn, because Until Dawn, it really felt like you were going out of your way to collect things. And as you say, this is just the camera. It makes it very clear when it's on screen. You have to, you know, you do have to look around the environment a little bit to find them, but it's not like you have to pick up a rock or, you know, go under some brush or do anything crazy out of the way. And I also like that they were really used in an interesting narrative way, because obviously the tarot cards, things like the star, the chariot, the tower, they all have clear connections to the characters that you're playing. And so not only would you be able to get a glimpse of a clip from the clairvoyant to let you know what may happen, but you also had to do some kind of divining of your own to figure out, okay, well, who in this cast is really like the devil card? Or who in this cast is the Empress, right? And I think that was a cool little moment for me, because it made me really think about what I was doing.
I think they're generally pretty good at making you think about these predictions, these like tiny glimpses of potential sequences, because you never know whether this is going to be a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah.
So someone opens a door and something happens, and then you don't know whether, should I open that door or should I not open that door when I encounter it? But you do at least know to pay specific attention for that particular moment. And I find that really cool.
I like that she also gives you the option, and this was technically just a gameplay option in Until Dawn. You could not see the totem. You could pick up the totem and not watch the clip. But what I really like is that the setup with the clairvoyant is that you have an option. You can pick to see a glimpse of the future, or you can choose to move on. And if you move on, she's like, all right, suit yourself. Not everybody wants to see everything.
She was actually really upset with me the first like three chapters, because I didn't find any tarot cards.
Me too.
I was looking in exactly the way that we described before. Like, I was walking around. I was like walking around on the edges of the level of the area in which you're in.
Yeah.
And I was like trying to lift up some kind of thing. And I was like, what are these cards? It can't be true. And then I realized, like, okay, that's not how you collect them at all.
She gets so upset with you. She's like, I left them there for you on purpose.
Yeah. She just kept, look harder. Yeah. Like, Jesus, I'm already trying my best.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to survive.
Listen, lady, I'm pretty on edge as it is, all right?
Yeah. I think that, to me, the most fun I had when I felt like my decisions really made a difference. And this is something that games have for a long time struggled with. Luckily, the Supermassive titles have always been pretty good at that.
Mm.
Of putting you into a situation where it's like, do you want to do this or that? And then you can choose whatever you want. And you might not get an immediate effect. There are some things, of course, where you have an immediate reaction. But there are also other choices that you make where things basically take a turn way later down the line. It's a principle of prolonged causality.
Mm.
It's super important to imbue players with a sense of power and autonomy. Because, are you going to, I give a brief example, are you going to pick up a set of firecrackers or not?
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to happen. You could pick them up and it could be useful because you could defend yourself, or it could be dangerous, as in you might harm yourself by picking them up and accidentally throwing them at someone. Way later on in the game, then you see the development of what this might come to and how they might help or harm you.
What I like about it too is that it doesn't pull the rug out from under you, where we were talking about how these characters conform to certain tropes. And I think that in my experience with the choices I made, I would think, okay, would Emma, for example, take these firecrackers? And based on the scene that had happened prior to that decision, I said, no, I think she's a little more pragmatic. And I don't think she would. That seems a little too mischievous for her. And so you think, okay, that's going to maybe help me later. And without giving any spoilers, it does, right? And so I think that it doesn't, it really makes you feel like your choices actually mean something, and that it rewards you for paying attention and trying to consider the narrative on its own terms.
Yeah, that's a lot more of the source of tension rather than actually being chased by a monster or having some kind of creepy creature coming after you, because you know that you have to always keep in mind that each character, I think, has about between 10 to 12 different ways to die throughout the game. And I can say that I'm quite well versed in playing these like decision-based horror games. And the first time I got all the way through to the ending, it was pretty terrible. It was pretty grim. Like, I didn't get that many people through.
Yeah. I think that it really doesn't cheapen any of the deaths, because all of these choices you make, you can kind of, one of the systems I loved in Until Dawn was that it was set up around the butterfly effect. That was the way that it was presented to you, is that these actions have ripples later on. And that's similar in the Quarry. And what I really love is that anytime somebody dies, it doesn't feel cheap, because you look back on all the things that you did and you said, oh, of course that was going to happen. Why didn't I see that? And that is a really cool source of tension, and not just like a disappointment or a fail state in a video game. I really like how they do that.
It doesn't have a fail state at all. Even when the most atrocious thing happens and you lose a character that you might really cherish, it's painful, but you have to move on, because as many of these games do, you have to live with every single decision that you make. I actually made a mistake very early on in the game. And then I thought, that was the first time I played it, I thought like, ah, damn it, I'm just gonna, you know, like load a checkpoint briefly and see whether I can do that better. I thought maybe if I just close the application and bring it back up, it would load the last checkpoint. But that's not the case. This game really plays like a film in that sense. If you turn it off and you turn it back on, you're exactly in the sequence where you had left off. So you can't undo anything except, and this is only unlocked when you've completed the first playthrough, you can trigger a rewind feature. And with that rewind feature, you can, throughout the entirety of the game, you can 3 times rewind the death of a character and try again to prevent it from happening.
It's a cool feature, and I think a way that strengthens the replay value of it, because you'll remember certain choices and you'll think ahead. I'm about 2 chapters into my second playthrough at this point, and I'm excited to do that. It doesn't feel like a chore to me, because there's so much that you don't see. In fact, there was one thing that I totally missed on my first playthrough that, speaking again to how it kind of rewards your paying attention to the narrative, there's an option early on when, as you mentioned, Jacob wants to spend another night at the camp so that he can try to prolong things with Emma, his crush. And you have a decision early on, how are you going to sabotage the minivan? And I was playing this with my girlfriend, and she made the brilliant observation, the 2 options are cut the fuel line or take the rotor arm from the engine. And she said, well, don't cut the fuel line. That's going to be impossible to fix if you need to get out of here. And so chose the rotor arm, and you think, okay, that's going to affect how I may escape. No. It has a different effect altogether, that you get to see like a particular piece of evidence to put the narrative together. So it does pull the rug out from under you, but it still rewards your thinking in the way that you thought, where, okay, this decision is going to be right. It was, but for reasons you totally missed, which is very cool.
Yeah, I think that's the brilliance of having such a black box where you have to make a decision, an informed decision, of course. But as at least in video game studies, it is often referred to as wicked problems, because you can't fully anticipate the consequences of what's going to happen, and you don't have all the information available to you. Because sometimes it's interesting that information is withheld, and you still have to be able to decide on some kind of grounds. It shouldn't just be random, just like in the case of how to sabotage the car. But you don't need to give players all kinds of information in order to make that decision. Just only a little bit, so that it remains interesting.
Wicked Problems would be a great Supermassive game title, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's also, in many ways, I think it is better than any other Supermassive game so far. The cast, for example, is one that I find the most impressive. The characters, I can't remember every single character from Until Dawn, but it seems to me, like, just from a personal recollection, as if the cast of The Quarry is the one I like the most, probably. Or this is probably something that has changed while playing through The Quarry. At the beginning, I felt they are all kind of douchebags. I don't like any of these people.
Yeah.
And it only comes over time. Yeah. Over time, some of the characters at least really grew on me over time. And I thought, like, I was always happy when I could play a character like Dylan, for example, who I got really kind of emotionally close to because he was such a charming person.
Yeah, I felt the exact same way. And I think that my favorites by the end of it ended up being Ryan and Dylan. Because I feel that they had, at least the way I play it, I don't know if this is true for everybody, but they had the most chemistry and they felt the most fleshed out. And whenever it changed over and you saw that you were playing as one of them, I got very excited to see how their story was going to progress.
I think my favorites were also Dylan and then I would say Caitlin.
Caitlin's hilarious. Mm. Yeah.
I have to say Caitlin. Because she's hilarious. She's also very beautiful, I must say. The hot one is not Caitlin, but Caitlin is the actual hot one. Yeah,
there's that great, we're not going to get into spoilers, but I do want to mention this. The line that cracked me up was when they were having, early in the game, there's a introduction to the shooting mechanic, and it's set up as a contest between two of the boys, Jacob and Nick, and Caitlin is officiating it. And she's being very bossy about how they're going to do this. And Jacob says, isn't she kind of hot when she gets bossy like that? And she's walking away and she's like, I'm always hot.
Yeah, it's just, she's got this kind of attitude. And she's also a character that I can mostly identify with. I think if I were in such a situation, then she's kind of the person that I would want to be. You know, she's often a little bit more of the voice of reason in situations, but she's not cold. Well, she can be a little bit cold and insulting, but yeah, it's just, it's pretty incredible voice acting. I think maybe we can even roll a brief clip because I remember I have clipped a very short sequence, a very brief dialogue from the game, which is spoiler free because it doesn't name any names of what's happening and it's only a couple of seconds long. Mm. But just as a brief introduction to how you can imagine the dynamic of the characters to be. So this is three people talking. You're going to hear Emma at the beginning, Dylan briefly in between, and Caitlin as well. It's just like a couple of seconds long. And then afterwards, we're going to take a little break and we'll be right back.
She can't be gone. She can't. It was quick. She didn't suffer. She was dead in seconds. What?
What's wrong with you? Just fix the car.
How did this all get so fucked up?
I know.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself
and for those facing homelessness,
because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
And we are back talking about The Quarry and the amazing diversity of choices that this game presents you with, because I do think it is quite beyond the standards of the games that Supermassive Games have made before. I found especially the mechanic pretty cool that you are sometimes presented with situations in which you can intervene or not intervene. This is not necessarily new, but it's implemented in a cool way so that intervening is not necessarily good or bad. You always have to ascertain in a very short time span whether intervening is the right thing to do or what you want to do.
A good example is, let's say you're walking through the woods as one of the characters and you're all alone and you hear a noise in the bushes. And so you get an interrupt prompt that says, do you want to call out? And you have to think in real time, well, okay, I could call out. Maybe it's somebody friendly, or more likely it's a monster that wants to eat me.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be quiet. So the better option there may be to let that interrupt pass you by and not do anything.
That's one of these classic examples where you can influence things so they don't feel like a typical horror movie, because then in a horror movie, it would always be like, hello, who's there? And it's like, why are you shouting?
No, you idiot.
If it's a monster, you're drawing all the attention to yourself.
Yeah. I do appreciate that. And I think this might also be a good time to say that the aesthetics of the game, while the backgrounds are really kind of bland and just spooky forest most of the time, one of the really fun inserts in the game is that the tutorials are these great animated sequences that are narrated by like a Rod Serling Twilight Zone type character. And I just remember one of them saying, sometimes the best option is to do nothing at all.
Yeah.
But yeah.
They are really cool comic shorts that are implemented there. They fit this kind of summer camp theme, and they are a little bit cute and funny, and they explain in a very concise way what you're going to do in which situation. It didn't help me getting tripped up by trying to hold my breath, because I was so used to it from Until Dawn. The thing is, they changed the mechanic. In Until Dawn, you would have the situation that if you had to, let's say you hide and there's a monster nearby and it's trying to sniff you out, and then your character has to hold their breath, then you would have to hold the controller very, very still. And the LED that was on top of the PS4 controller, the DualShock 4, then it would be tracked. And any kind of movement you made, that might be detrimental. And that was kind of cool because it encouraged you as a player to sit very still and be very tense, just like the character is. They changed that and they made it now a button prompt where you have to just hold down the X button. It's a lot easier to do, and I see why they changed it. I think it is probably an improvement, because this Until Dawn mechanic where you had to actually hold still, it was so glitchy. It was so sensitive. Yeah. How many times a character in Until Dawn has died during my playthroughs because accidentally something happened? Just imagine you have to sneeze. Oh my God, terrible.
I wonder if this were a PS5 exclusive, if they would have done something interesting with the haptic feedback on the controller, because I was kind of expecting that. There wasn't a whole lot of that in this game, and you kind of do think in a more cinematic game, they might utilize that to their advantage more, but that may be the result of it being cross-platform and not being able to be so specific to different hardware. But yeah, I think it was certainly easier, and I will say that it got me once. And it resulted in the death of a character that I was very upset about.
Ah, that sounds painful.
Yeah. And because I don't know if you had this, but I kept expecting there will be a time where I think I'm safe with half of my breath left, and then the thing will come back and I won't be safe. Did you ever have that moment where you thought, I can't let go just yet because it's going to come back?
Yes. I always wait until the point where I think now I'm definitely, definitely safe.
Yeah. I did not wait. Oh, I waited too long, I think, and at one point.
You missed your window.
I did. And so it's a very tense mechanic, and I like that it plays with your expectations, especially if you're not only an Until Dawn fan, but a horror fan in general, because it's kind of twisting your mind up a little bit.
Ah, it's really nice. And I think it also improved a lot in the relationship department, because in Until Dawn, it was already the case that each character had these attributes and there were these relationships that you could establish. In the Dark Pictures anthology, they really went overboard with this by indicating in detail all kinds of like almost character stats.
And oh, yeah.
While that can be nice, it was just too intricate. It was overcomplicated. And here in The Quarry, they reduced it to basically a brief textual insert that just says, I don't know, Dylan is disappointed in you. Or basically like, X will remember this, which is a classic line. Clementine will remember this.
Some of them really cut to the quick too, because there's one I think that we both got that was, the group is getting bored of Ryan.
Yeah. At the very beginning, you can trigger that. Yeah.
Breaks your heart.
It's like, come on, dude's not that boring.
Be nice. Yeah.
But I think still that they could reduce it further. If I could make changes in the way that it's displayed, I would say leave it out entirely. It violates the principle of show, don't tell. Don't tell me that the group is getting bored of Ryan. Show me how the group is getting bored of Ryan by the way the group behaves. I think that would be favorable. These textual inserts, they always felt a little bit out of place for me.
Well, and sometimes it almost goes against what you think the tone of the scene is, where you'll say, oh, really? They felt that way? Okay. And I think that I totally agree with you. It is a little intrusive. It kind of takes you out of the moment. And with the motion capture being so impressive, you know, we're not talking LA noir anymore. You know, these are really impressive facial features like we talked about, and different reactions. So I think a fun middle ground would be, because the technology is so incredible, don't have those textual inserts, but keep them in the sort of journal aspect in the main menu, where you get sort of a breakdown of how different choices affected the story. If you put those reactions written down there, then you could reflect on it later and say, oh, I read his facial expression as disappointed, and I was correct. He was disappointed
in this text
option.
That's a really interesting observation, though, because I often had that situation that I felt like the insert popped up, Ryan is disappointed, and I looked at the character and I thought, no, he's not. He seems fine. Yeah. he didn't seem to say, he just seemed like neutral, like, okay, whatever, you know, it's like, it's fine.
Yeah.
I think when you have such high profile actors at your disposal and such impressive motion capture technology, then you should be able to convey these reactions in the faces of the characters without being, as you said, LA noir overboard, where it's like when someone's lying, they're like all over the place.
Oh man. Like tugging at their collar and they have their eyebrows up to their forehead.
Ryan is disappointed and like grabs his head being like, no,
no, I am very disappointed. I do think that that did take me out quite a bit. And you know what else? I don't know if you got this. How did you feel about so at a certain point you get options to say, to respond to something, and it'll say like compliant or defiant. Those are your two options.
Yeah.
And then it'll say directly underneath it what the character will say. So I actually kind of liked that, because in so many games, it's such a joke that you'll choose an option and it'll just say sarcastic. But then what the character says, you're like, that's not sarcastic.
Yeah.
Why did you say it that way? I don't understand. I didn't want to say it. I didn't want to say that. I wanted to be sarcastic. So I appreciated that it gave you a little glimpse into what was actually going to be said.
I think that is one of the classic problems of Mass Effect, isn't it?
100%.
Yeah. Or you choose something and then you're like, oh, that's not at all what I meant. That's not at all what I wanted to say. I think it's smart.
Yeah.
I think the compliant or defiant things, they are probably only there to give you a little bit of a framework, because you only see like the first couple of words, or it's like a brief blurb basically of what you're going to say, and you can't always immediately deduce. It would maybe also take too long to make these informed decisions. That's why I think it's cool. I do like that there's no good and evil system, or nice and bad. It's like often it's like you have something like empathetic or dismissive, where it's very clear, but that's not always the case. Like you don't always have an option where one is necessarily the right thing to do and the other one is not. And I think that's cool.
Yeah, it makes you think about what's actually going to happen, because it's always a binary option, but it doesn't set it up as good and bad.
Yeah.
There's nuance to each of the choices that I think, like I remember again early with Nick and Abigail, Abigail goes to draw something, and the options for Nick are to be sincere and say, wow, you're really good at drawing, or to be like silly and say, draw me. And I chose draw me because I thought, oh, we'll be flirty. And she did not like that. So you never know what's going to happen, really. You have to kind of think about, all right, how are these characters interacting and what would be the right thing to say here?
That's something that you could rather do when you know a person. Then you can ascertain that a little bit better. But in this case, it's kind of cool because Nick and Abby are, they're kind of a little bit in a, like they're starting to flirt a little bit, but they're both kind of shy about it and not really expressive with their emotions. And so it makes perfect sense that such mistakes would happen, that Nick would accidentally offend her and then maybe react to it in some kind of way that even contributes to their bond eventually. I think that's cool that you're not incentivized to basically decide that this character is going to be a douchebag now, and then it has to be consistently a douchebag in order to achieve some kind of result.
It's a fine tightrope they're walking because it's a very simple game in terms of gameplay, and yet the options you get are very full of depth. And I think that that's pretty impressive to have just two options and you really have to think, how am I going to respond here? And one thing I really like is that those dialogue options that you get, those aren't timed. So the quick time events, those obviously are quick time events. But if you're choosing what to say, there's no timer with how you're going to react. So you can sit and think for a little bit if you need to.
It doesn't rush you. And even when it does, when it requires a quick time event input, which is almost the default thing that happens when you're in some kind of conflict or combat interaction, and even sometimes just randomly when someone accidentally throws down a coffee mug and you have to catch it or something, or a phone drops and you're like, wow, I caught the
There's a lot of key throwing in the game.
They always throw things, don't they? Is that what people just do in the US? They always like throw the phone, or always like throw the keys and say, come on, you can just take a step towards me. Always, get to me.
Always overhand too. Yeah. It's never a toss underhanded. It's always just full on like throwing a baseball at somebody.
It's a phone. It can break. Don't throw it at me. I think, though, that the QuickTime events, right? The thing is that the framework is clearly one of an interactive movie. So this game is not necessarily challenging in a gameplay way. And most of the time, these QuickTime events, they are so easy that you can just simply say like, okay, I'll just press, you only ever press the stick in a direction. They made it so simple that you don't even have to press like different buttons or sequences of buttons or something, or hold a button and press another one. No, you only have to press the left stick in a direction and sometimes hammer the X button. And that's it already. Yeah. Like, it's super simple. That makes it very accessible. And there are only very few sequences in which you're actually challenged to, let's say, aim at something and shoot. And that's not necessarily easy. It sounds super easy, but it isn't. Like, I played so many games in which you shoot things. I can say that in The Quarry, I think I missed every single shot. Just because it was then such a hectic situation that I was like, whoop. It was already done.
It is hectic, and I think none of the, with the exception of maybe Caitlin, none of the kids are marksmen.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that you're going to have a hard time figuring out where to shoot.
None of them is Chris Redfield, unfortunately.
No.
He would definitely improve the entire game a lot.
Boy, he would, yeah. Well, I think maybe this is a good segue into how the narrative is set up, because the last thing that I want to say about the QuickTime events is that it's, I think our instinct as gamers is to succeed in QuickTime events. And we already mentioned that there are some options where you can just say, I'm not going to choose this. I don't want to call out. I don't want to shoot into the bushes. But there are other QuickTime events like the stick movements that you mentioned, where there's one sequence in particular that drastically changes the outcome of a particular character if you fail certain QuickTime events and succeed in others. So it really is like, again, the depth of QuickTime events is surprising in this game. Yeah, and it leads to really varied outcomes for the characters in the story.
It does. These outcomes are quite surprising, though I must say, never really creepy. I found them not really scary. I really I'm not like a hardcore horror dude. I have seen such things like Insidious and The Grudge and a lot of these slasher films that it references as well.
Yeah.
I didn't ever feel properly scared in The Quarry, and I feel like that might be part of the point of the game. Whereas Until Dawn was a little bit more concerned with actually setting up proper scares, The Quarry is more like, it's more like setting up tension rather than scares. For example, you get to see the monsters relatively early on. You do know...
Chapter 2.
You do know what you ought to be afraid of, basically. There are more mysteries involved that you can unravel if you get all the characters to stay alive. And if you unravel the story behind everything, finding clues, and that's cool. That's like an interesting mystery that you can unravel over time. But it never really was a game that made me feel scared, or where after turning off the lights, I would be like, oh, I don't want to be in the dark.
Well, this is where I want to go back to the whole mystery idea.
Yeah.
Because I think Until Dawn had genuinely unnerving moments. I am a hardcore horror fan. I love horror movies, books, everything. And I really appreciate when something... Here's what I look for in a horror movie or a game. I'm not scared. I don't jump, but I just go, oh, I don't like that. Mm-hmm. That feeling is what I crave when I watch things. And Until Dawn for me was full of those. And what I loved about it was that Until Dawn is kind of two games until you get to the end and you realize, oh no, it was one really well put together story the entire time. And there are certain moments that you reveal certain things and come to certain realizations that are so gut-wrenchingly terrifying and creepy. I miss that in The Quarry. And I think I may have set expectations a bit too high because unlike I didn't do the dark pictures, so I didn't know the full extent of the kind of disappointment of Supermassive. And so I went in thinking, oh, it's aesthetically like Until Dawn. There's all these teenage characters again. I bet there's going to be some kind of twist. And there was a little bit of one, or not really a twist, more of a reveal that explained everything. But it just didn't have the same scary oomph that Until Dawn did.
It does go very steadily, at a very steady pace, at gradually feeding you information. It never really surprises, and it never really disappoints. I felt like it was a very consistently good story that unraveled. Because I think each of these mysteries, in quotation marks, that The Quarry holds, in themselves, they are not particularly interesting or special, but the way that they interlink is rather neat. Because I felt like, at the beginning of playing The Quarry, I felt like, wow, there's like five different horror trope mysteries going on here in the background that I'll need to unravel. And am I hunted by like three different threats? What is going on? And I think over time, it unravels things... I would say, in a satisfying way, not in an excellent way, or as you said, in a gut-wrenching way, but so that you can say, okay, that was cool. Like that was nice.
I think there's one moment where I went, oh no, there was a reveal that bummed me out because I made a choice that I later realized could have been prevented because of information that's given to you later in the kind of final chapters. But I think that without getting into spoilers for what the monsters in either game are, I will say the other thing that really affected me in Until Dawn that's not present in The Quarry is that in The Quarry, a lot of the scariness is reversible. There's a whole there's a whole part of the narrative that is, without giving anything away, there is an infection that can be cured.
Yes.
And in Until Dawn, it's very clear, no, that is permanent and terrifying and a fate worse than death. And if you go that route, it's worse than anything else in the universe.
Until Dawn is a little bit more fatalistic than The Quarry is.
Yeah. Higher stakes, I think.
Higher stakes. And the characters, at least in Until Dawn, the characters also take things a bit more seriously than in The Quarry. Mm-hmm. The Quarry is a little bit more lighthearted in many ways. Even when something grueling happens, just as one brief example, without spoiling too much, there is a sequence in which one character can have their hand cut off. And this is terrible. If this happens to you, this is terrible. You might be in shock for a second and you might not realize what's happening. Okay, fair enough. But in The Quarry, it's literally like, oh yeah, okay, maybe that wasn't such a good idea. You know, it's like, maybe I can get a cool prosthesis, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's also a deliberate Evil Dead reference, which kind of, if you're a horror fan, makes you realize, oh, this is meant to be a little more playful than anything that happens in Until Dawn.
But can it be a little bit impactful at least? I was thinking to myself, like, maybe because I've worked in the emergency room for quite a while and I just looked at that thing and I just thought, like, I wonder whether Supermassive Games know what an arterial bleeding is, because that's not what happens. It's not like because you're in shock, it might not bleed, okay, but only for a second or something.
Yeah.
And it will bleed and it will be like, no, or, tomorrow, and you'll be in grave danger.
Yeah, or do another horror trope and have somebody cauterize it, you know? I was expecting that at some point. Like, oh, we got to put your hand in the fire. Come on, man.
Yeah. It's just like, nah, I don't have a hand anymore.
Wrap it up. I'm good. Nah. I think he takes Advil at one point.
Yeah.
I'm good.
I'll take a painkiller. I'm fine. It actually doesn't hurt that much. And it's this is the case consistently. Like, we're using this one hand example here, which is, though, representative of many of the, let's say, injuries and harm that the characters face, which never really seems to phase them in a substantial way. Like, the screaming in fear is more like a reaction that just is part of being a character in a horror thing.
Yeah, I think it's... I totally agree. I don't know that I was never scared. I was more intrigued, and I think it felt more like a fantasy story than it did a horror story, like Until Dawn did. Mm, and that's fine.
That's fair.
But I was expecting more creepiness. Yeah. And I think the creepiest it is in the prologue, and then it's not very scary after that, I would say.
So don't expect to be at the edge of your seat and being like scared in a way that some psychological horror films would be able to scare you, but rather to be entertained, I would say.
Yeah. Maybe fitting that the narrator in Until Dawn is a psychiatrist and the narrator here is like a carnival worker.
Yeah. Like clairvoyant. Yeah. It also has, it's very aware of the way in which people play these games by offering you three different modes of playing it. Mm. There's obviously, like, there's a standard single player mode where you cycle through the characters. There's a couch co-op where you play with, you can play with several different people, I guess, and assign characters, and then you just pass on the controller. Or you can play in movie mode, which I also tried briefly, which is kind of interesting. In movie mode, you can choose between three options. Either you choose that everyone lives, and then you basically just lean back and you watch the entire thing unfold. They just edit out the sequences where characters would be like moving around and where nothing happens, and only edit the parts where something is discovered or an interaction happens, and you don't make any decisions whatsoever. You just watch. The same with the option of having a movie mode in which everyone dies, if you just want to, for the lols, see how that turns out. And then there's even a third option where you can set some parameters. You can define each character's behavior patterns, how quick their reactions are, so basically how successful they are at quick time events. And then you can just basically you set up the parameters and then you just let the story play out and see what happens.
It's pretty cool. And I think it makes the option of, okay, I want to play through just blind and see what happens. And then maybe I don't want to play through a second time, but I do want to know what happens if, you know, everybody survives. So I'll just watch it. And I think that's a cool feature for a game like this.
It totally is, yeah. Online multiplayer, though, is not available as of this point because the team and server were actually located in Ukraine and Supermassive is currently moving them, so they had to delay the launch of the online multiplayer. It's going to launch presumably on July 8th. And I think they made the right decision here because the thing is that with the Dark Pictures anthology, the online multiplayer was always a little bit clunky, up to the point where in The House of Ashes, we didn't really get it to work at all. Like once or twice it worked and it was like super spotty in the way it worked. Now, I appreciate that they put a little bit more time into this, and it seems that there will be this online multiplayer mode where you play the game and then there are up to 7 spectators that watch you play, and they can vote on decisions, and then the decision that has the most votes will the one that is being picked. I think this is really cool because it is very much inspired by the sense of disconnect that we have experienced during the pandemic, where you can't just play with people like that, but you can then have this kind of interactive movie experience where everyone votes and you just watch things unfold. I think that's pretty neat.
It is. And I think it's cool too, because it feels like it's inspired by and built for streamers too, to have these kind of watch party events. I know there's like a streamer mode where it takes out all the copyrighted music.
Yeah.
But the idea that you're at the helm, you're sitting there with the controller, but you know, 8 friends are saying, no, we should do it this way. That's really, that again, replay value skyrockets with that because it can become like a party game at that point.
Yeah, they actually have some experience with that as well because they made a game called Hidden Agenda beforehand, which is also like an interactive movie where you can just join with your phone and then you make certain decisions, but one of the players gets a certain objective to sabotage the goal of the players, and then you have to kind of find out who is sabotaging you. So the game in itself is not particularly great, but it's like for a short party game where it's like a 1 hour thriller thing that you can play maybe before you go out with friends. That's pretty neat. Definitely worth it.
Yeah, cool idea. Well, perhaps we've been pretty laudatory of this game at this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
no game is without its flaws.
Indeed.
And I think it's worth mentioning that there are quite a few flaws in The Quarry.
There are.
We don't have to get into all of them, but there are some glaring ones for sure.
Yeah, I found, for example, the camera work on the one hand quite impressive. On the other, whenever you have control over the camera yourself, it seemed very finicky and all over the place. I feel like even this mechanic of controlling the flashlight, you're basically walking through a corridor and you control the flashlight with the right stick, they did this better in previous games. Here it's just a little bit like it happened all the time that the character would just like look at the ceiling all of a sudden and so on. Like the flashlight was way too sensitive for the camera movement.
Yeah. No, the characters are always looking up to the point where I thought there was something hiding in the rafters all the time. Yeah. But I think the other thing that kind of drove me nuts and really took me out of it was this is a beautiful game when it comes to motion capture, but then other textures are all over the place. There's a scene with two characters in a lake and they're splashing each other. And the water, I mean, it looked like it was like clip art. It looked really bad to the point where there's an option to splash again, one of those interrupt options. And I chose not to do it because I didn't want to see the water again.
It is pretty terrible, yes. And I think it probably goes to show that they put a lot of effort in the facial animations and not so much in the especially interactive parts of the environment. Yeah. Often these things are just like still images and then they're cool. But as soon as you interact with things, it gets weird quickly.
Yeah. And
I think it could have done with a little bit more time. Also with such tiny quirks, like for example, I don't know whether this happened for you, but for me, there was several sequences where the subtitles suddenly activated just for like one thing where it's like, what? And then it disappears again.
No, that happened. I think we're talking about the exact same moment. Was it at the beginning?
Yeah. It happened at the beginning and then throughout the game more times.
I think it only happened to me once because I turned subtitles on shortly after that because I was playing in the dark and I wanted to make sure I was getting all the information.
Yeah.
Yeah, that totally, I thought that happened. It happens in a scene where there's kind of a ghost involved and I thought, oh, is the ghost messing with things? What's happening to my game?
That would be such a cool thing, but you know what happened to me? There was like a sequence where something was revealed, and then in the subtitles, I had them turned off entirely, and suddenly subtitle popped up and said, shocked. And I was like, okay. Talk about show, don't tell, you know? Shocked. It's like...
That's great.
Okay. There would be a really good idea, though. It would have been a really good idea for them to have like these ghost-like interventions in the system or something.
No, I thought, oh, be hopeful for a minute that they're doing something kind of fun. But no, it was just a weird glitch. Oh, well.
Shall we briefly address the fact that a central part of the narrative is actually circled around a podcast?
Yes, I would. I have a note in our, you know, we always notate our show. For those of you listening, and I have a note that specifically says we are better podcasters than Bizarre Yet Bonafide.
Bizarre Yet Bonafide. That was a joke that I made in the intro, but I found it. Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a fake podcast, but and it plays out in its entirety during the credits, if I recall correctly. There's like a whole episode. Yeah. This goes on for a long time. Like the entire credit sequence is basically just you listening to a like 15-minute podcast.
It's interesting because if you remember. The Until Dawn epilogue is the police questioning the survivors, which is sort of where they draw everything together. And that's what they were doing with the podcast, where it's these two podcasters who are telling ghost stories and looking into murder and the paranormal. And they kind of break down what happened in the game, which is an interesting idea.
It made me think we should do maybe a video game mystery podcast.
Oh, that'd be great. Yes, we should.
we've done an episode before on like cursed video games something, right?
Yeah, where we were, oh yeah, I like this idea. We can do an unsolved mysteries episode of games. Yeah.
Yes.
Put that in the file.
Studying Pixel's Bizarre Yet Bonafide.
Yes, there we go.
Overall, I would say The Quarry, it's definitely worth a playthrough. Mm. I enjoyed it, especially for the first time and even for the second time around by getting a whole lot more information out of things and paying close attention to the developments, making different decisions. So I would say if this game came out 10 years ago, it would have completely blown my mind. Nowadays, I would say it's a good game. Mm. It is a return to form. I would say please, please, Supermassive Games, don't go down the road of the Dark Pictures anthology. It just didn't work. And you know what I would like to see them do the most? A game that's not horror at all. I think they are cool. They're really good at, you know, character development. And I think they could tell a wonderful story without going into the horror tropes, like a genuinely heartfelt story, a decision-based slice of life story. Oh my God, I would find that absolutely delicious.
Slice of life, or I think they would do really well with a detective story.
Detective crime or mystery story.
Kind of like their take on Heavy Rain. I think they would, their character writing is so good. I think that it would be really nice. And I love when they lean into the mystery aspect of things, I think it's really compelling. And so I think a thriller detective story would be great for them.
Yeah. So it's a horror game that's better as a mystery game, basically.
I think so. And I think a lot of horror stories are better as mysteries because
that's true.
It's all about surprise, right? And so when things come together, you know, it feels more like people always say that horror and comedy are very similar because a laugh is the same as a scream. You're just surprised. And I think that horror works better when you are in on the joke at the end of it and you've put everything together. So
yeah. If I may say one thing to that, because
oh, please.
I actually just realized, of course, the thing that I like the least about a lot of horror things is jump scares.
Yeah.
Because jump scares are cheap. Jump scares is just like suddenly something pops up and you didn't expect it. Fair enough. I have no problem with a jump scare here and there to basically loosen me up a little bit for the rest of the stuff and to grab my attention. But truly, I agree with the idea that good horror stories are good mystery stories because you are intrigued and you want to know what happened, what's behind this, and how can it be fixed if it can be fixed at all.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that would absolutely be a good principle to go in. So yeah, let's say they shall do a proper mystery or crime game. I think that would be really good at that.
Yes. And I think the last thing I'll say is that I do recommend this game. I think it's worth going in. And we did a really good job, I would say, to pat ourselves on the back. We didn't spoil anything. Play the game. It's really interesting and it's a good story. I will say this though. I bought this game for $70. I think I overpaid. I think that this game is... it's incredible. A lot of work went into it, of course. So I know that I don't want to take work or time away from the people who put it together because it is really good looking and a well put together game, with the exception of the water textures. But I will say that it's probably more worth it for you to play when it comes down in price a bit. I would say maybe more like the $40 to $50 range is more fair. It just, coming off of Elden Ring especially, which is $60, $70, and as you said, Stefan, 200 plus hours of content, it feels like a weird step down for the same price. So that would be my thought on it.
Well, thank you so very much for listening. Please feel free to submit your thoughts and questions on studyingpixels.com/contact. If you want to support us and make this show happen, then you can get Studying Pixels Plus. Please visit studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more about that. You can follow us on your podcast app. And of course, you can reach out on social media. Wonderful talking to you. It's always a treat. Thank you, Dan, for the wonderful conversation about The Quarry.
Oh, likewise.
And then we're going to talk again next week. See you then. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.